The first half of that chapter of Mark's Gospel, chapter 11, I think is an interesting presentation of the challenges that face prophets, people who are trying to speak truth to those in power. The chapter begins with John the Baptist in prison. He's wondering, quite legitimately, I think, whether Jesus is the Messiah that they've been waiting for, and he puts the question to Jesus through his by sending some disciples, because according to Matthew, he's heard reports of the things that Jesus has done in the various towns and villages in Israel, but I suppose John isn't seeing the kinds of actions that he expects to see of a Messiah. So he puts the question: are you the one that we've been waiting for, or not? Should we be looking for someone else? And Jesus responds by suggesting to John that he needs to make up his own mind about that, about whether he's the Messiah or not, but that Jesus' actions should speak for themselves. And he says, tell John what you've seen. The blind are receiving their sight, the lame walk, lepers are being healed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised to life, and then finally the poor have received good news. It's, to my mind, not a highly theological response, but it is an echo of the passages or the passage from Isaiah that we're told in Luke's Gospel Jesus read to kickstart his ministry in Nazareth. It's a response that invites John, and I suppose anyone else for that matter, to believe the evidence of their eyes and ears. Look what you're seeing, look what you hear what you're hearing, and make your draw your conclusions. The problem, though, with that, believing the evidence of your own eyes and ears, is that, as I've suggested in other meditations at other times, we tend to see and hear what we expect to see and hear. Or sometimes we see and hear what we want to see and hear. And Jesus underlines, I think, that reality very clearly in the verses 16 to 19 that I just read in chapter 11. His little comparison of the generation of his day to children playing in the marketplace is, I think, a pretty damning condemnation of those who refuse to recognize the validity of John's message and who equally refuse the validity of his own message. We piped and you wouldn't dance. You wailed and you wouldn't mourn. John the Baptist, of course, is the ascetic whose message is rejected because he's too eccentric, he's too serious, and he's accused of having a demon. Jesus, of course, is the piper whose message is rejected because he's not serious enough. And he's accused of being a glutton and a drunkard, partying with sinners and publicans and all the rest of it. In other words, these men adopting a prophetic stance are in a no-win position as far as the authorities are concerned and as far as maybe, you know, the people in general are concerned. It doesn't matter what they say. It doesn't matter what they do. Their message is, from the beginning, going to be rejected out of hand because their audience simply doesn't want to hear it. And they'll look for any excuse to disqualify them. And that's, I think, the dilemma for any prophet. Or any human rights worker, or any well-intentioned seeker after justice. The words challenging injustice may be perfectly reasonable. The actions engaged in may be perfectly respectable and responsible, but those in positions of power will always tend to see and hear what they want to see and hear. And so the nonviolent protester pleading for change in the eyes of powers that be becomes an anarchist. The community organizer who's helping their community advocate for better access to services becomes a troublemaker. The politician promoting universal health care for all becomes a socialist. Not an insult to my mind, but then I guess I would comfortably describe myself as a socialist. So Jesus recognizes that the struggle for justice is an uphill battle. He takes that as a given. He recognizes that the message will not be readily accepted by all, and that those who want to see change will need to resign themselves to the fact that they will face resistance. It just comes with the turf. I remember when I started working at Maison de l'Amitié some 31 and a half years ago and began my work with refugees and asylum seekers, I found the first couple of years particularly challenging. And there was, of course, a learning curve that I had to climb as I tried to gain an understanding of government policies that were in place around refugees and asylum seekers. And as I tried to get a handle on the day-to-day reality of the functioning of the refugee determination process. But the real challenge for me, I guess on an emotional level, was coming to terms with a system that, flawed as it was at least built to determine whether someone needed protection and then to offer protection to that person. So coming to terms with a system that, though it may have had its flaws, I thought was basically sound and fundamentally good, but it was under constant pressure to change. And I don't mean pressure from refugee activists like myself who were pushing for improvements and who tended to highlight flaws in the system that limited protection for those in need. The detractors that I had in mind were those who felt that the process was too generous, too easy, too welcoming, too open, people who would have liked to close the doors to refugees altogether. So always people always looking to claw back whatever gains had been made. And that's on the refugee front, but in any other human rights field or any other area of social protections, there's always someone or some group looking to claw back for one reason or another. And at the time, the local coalition of organizations working with refugees and newcomers, settlement agencies, we had monthly meetings where we would discuss issues, where we would strategize around how to seek improvements for the lives of the people we were working with. And at one of those monthly meetings, I remember, and I've mentioned this before at another meditation, I think, I remember whining to a colleague who worked with refugee sponsorships for the Archdiocese of Montreal, Sister Denise Lenné, a little nun about 5 feet, nothing tall, and a couple of decades older than myself. She'd asked me how things were going, and I moaned about the fact that I felt like I was feeling pretty disheartened because it felt like we were wading through mud, expending all our energy, trying to keep from slipping backwards rather than making any progress forward. But Denise was having none of that moaning from me. She knew that I was a lapsed Catholic turned Mennonite, and she craned her neck up to me and in no uncertain terms gave me a dressing down. And she said, "John, what kind of a Christian are you? Isn't that what the gospel is all about? To wade against the stream when the stream is obviously moving in the wrong direction? And to not lose heart just because the going gets tough sometimes." And at that point, I think Denise had already been working with refugees for probably about 40 years since just after the Second World War. And she'd never lost sight of the fact that she was doing God's work throughout all of that time. She'd never questioned whether the energy required was worth the effort or whether the occasional setback was a sign of failure. She'd never doubted that the work was necessary, important, and that she was where she needed to be. She'd never lost hope. It's not that Denise was a masochistic, ascetic, John the Baptist type, sort of reveling in rejection, struggle, and pain. Not that at all. But neither was she an unfailing optimist, a sort of a Pollyanna chanting feel-good mantras, you know, it's going to be okay, it's going to be... She wasn't like that at all. She was simply committed to doing what she felt called to do. And she wasn't going to let anything distract her from continuing to do her best in spite of the resistance that would inevitably be a part of her reality. And she embraced her life, the struggle for justice with its occasional setback, alongside her ability to celebrate the occasional victory and to simply enjoy the life that she'd been given alongside the refugees that she was working with. And I've always kind of liked the idea that Jesus was accused of being a glutton and a drunkard. I doubt very much that he was either of those things. But I like this image of a Jesus who embraces life with gusto, who's not afraid to break out of the rigid regimentation of the religious leaders and able to model a capacity for entering into relationships that acknowledges the inherent worth of the people he's connecting with, the religious conformity of those people aside. To me, it seems he embraced life with all of its diversity. And you see that even in the fact, I mean, he's partying with outcasts of society in spite of the scorn that he risks bringing on himself because he's embracing them with all of their flaws. He flaunts the norms of religious observance when he's healing on the Sabbath or when he and his disciples pick grain on the Sabbath. He converses with Samaritan women of all people and uses a Samaritan as a hero in one of his parables. He clearly loved children and insisted that they be valued and protected. And he holds unfailingly to his mission to convince his people that their relationships with each other were a measure of their relationship with God. And he had his share, of course, of those who accused him of being the first century equivalent of an anarchist, a troublemaker, and a socialist. But he holds unfailingly to his mission, knowing that it might well bring him ultimately to a confrontation with those in a position to do to him what they had done to John the Baptist and to many of the prophets who preceded them. And I like very much this image of a Jesus calmly, steadfastly challenging what he knows to be wrong. When I was a young Christian, in my very early 20s, I had an album by an American evangelical Christian singer by the name of Keith Green. This particular album was entitled No Compromise, and that album was part of my formative growing experience as a young Christian, as I was trying to figure out what it meant to be a faithful disciple of Christ. Now, Green's approach to that understanding was, of course, strictly evangelical. You must be born again and get out there and spread the word. And while my own understanding has grown in a somewhat different direction, the album cover has remained with me for all of these years as part of the subtle backdrop to my own life. The cover, it's a sort of a painting of a dignitary being carried on a litter past a crowd of people who are all prostrate, sort of flat on the ground, bowing to this dignitary. All of them are prostrate, except one person who remains defiantly erect, standing up out of the crowd. You know, you can't be missed, attracting the attention of a soldier on a horse behind the dignitary, who's pointing him out and obviously indicating that he's about to be arrested and punished. I don't remember any of the music from that album or any of the message from the songs, but I have a vivid image of that cover in my mind, and it stayed with me. And the calm resolve of this one individual, surrounded by tacit pressure to conform and protect himself, has always inspired me. I'm no hero. I hate conflict with a passion. But I aspire to the strength and conviction embodied in that image. And the image itself from that album cover is apparently intended to depict the actions of Mordecai in the Book of Esther. That particular story about Mordecai has a very happy ending for Mordecai. He's not arrested and punished. It goes absolutely the opposite way. But I've always thought of that it was an image of Jesus, calmly resolved to stand up against the religious authorities of the day, as well as calmly standing against the injustices of the Roman Empire, holding unfailingly to his mission to convince us that we, all of us, Christians, Jews, Romans, atheists, are called to enter into right relationships with each other. A man willing to stand for just behavior when everyone else is prostrate before the powers that be. A man willing to dance when the pipe plays and mourn when tragedy strikes, to share his life with those around him. A man willing to do all of this knowing that the cross and the apparent failure that that may represent might be just around the corner. But a man willing to do all of this, knowing that the cross and the apparent failure that it may represent is not the final word on the matter. There is resurrection. Thank you.